My name is Russell Spatz, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm a member of the Carl Gables Group of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's a great pleasure and privilege to be here. It's a great privilege whenever I'm asked to chair an AA group, an AA meeting, or something like that. And I've been, I haven't found it necessary to take a drink, nor have I. You know, you have to add, nor have I. You hear about those two guys in Texas? One guy says, I haven't found it necessary to take a drink in 20 years. And the other guy says, Joe, I saw you drunk last night. He said, yeah, but it wasn't necessary. But I haven't found it necessary to take a drink, nor have I had a drink since January 25th, 1981. And I'm grateful for that. And if I'm lucky enough and privileged enough and blessed enough to make it, I guess I'll have 31 years in January, next month sometime. So And I have been going every Christmas Eve. Well, I think I almost go every night. I think I go all the time to AA meetings, and we'll get into that later, but it's not something unusual for me. It's just the way I was brought up. It was the way my sponsors did it and the way all the old-timers did it. You know, they just, that's just the way we did it. AA became, you know, I mean, I started out like most people in Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't want this to get, you know, I didn't want this to take over my life. I wanted to have some balance, which meant maybe once in a while. And unfortunately, I stayed a bit too long in it, and it warped me. And I don't know. I have been married for 30 years, and I have 4 children and 6 grandchildren, and I'm self-supporting through my own contributions. I wouldn't trade my life for anybody's life, and you know, and sponsor quite a few people and work with a lot of people, very active with my church, which I'll get into a little bit on that, which is a pretty good, decent thing for a Jewish kid from New York. But as a matter of fact, I'm a deacon there, and I was there at 5:30 tonight, 5 o'clock tonight, doing the Christmas service. The truth of the matter is the reason I have incredible balance in my life. And the reason why I've found that peace that they talk about that you find here, experiencing much of heaven and being rocketed in the fourth dimension of existence, of which I'd not even dreamed, is somewhere along the line I stopped looking for balance in my life, and I decided to put all my cards and all my chips on the God deal. And I started believing them when they say, see to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. And ever since I've put 100% of my deal on him, he's given me everything else. And every time I'm working with somebody, I see somebody who's trying to get balance in their life, they're always joining the groups of the thumb-sucking crybabies and worrying about all the stuff they don't have or can't have or they're losing. So I'll just talk a little bit about what happened to me, and I'm just reporting. You know, this is just my reportage on my life. I'm 62 years old, and what I did, and you don't have to, you know, I know how alcoholics are. They hear things that aren't said. That's why they say the wrongdoings of others, fancied or real. That's like real or imagined, because half the stuff we're pissed at never happened. Half the people we're pissed out at because of what they said to us never said anything to us. 99% of the people that we know are thinking bad things about us don't even know we exist. And so I want you to understand this is just my life, my opinions, my deal. It has nothing to do with you. You happen to be in the room. Some of you might actually hear what I say. I have had people come up to me after meetings and say to me, you know, man, I'll tell you, you changed my life when you said this. And I never said that. It was close, you know what I mean? Close enough for government. But hey, that's what they heard. And that's what they needed to hear. So I'm not here just because I'm telling you I did something. You know what I mean? Doesn't mean you have to do it. You know, you do your own thing. It's your own life. You know, that kind of thing. I really don't want to take credit for what happens in your life. And I don't, anybody who I sponsor who stays sober, I don't take credit for their sobriety. They may get up here and or say something and say, you know, Russell, whatever. I don't take credit for their sobriety. I don't take credit or blame if they get drunk. And so I'm just going to try to accurately report the deal. I guess as accurate as an alcoholic could, could be. It says in the big book, it says further on, I don't do a whole bit drunk, a big drunkalogue. I guess I'm capable. I used to do it. You know, they say your story changes. You know, when I first came in, it was pretty much a drunk, you know, and then I drank, and then, you know, most of our stories, our drunkalogues are the same, and then I drank, and then I drank, and then I drank, and this happened, then I drank. You know, and they're funny, and they're good, and they're, and there's nothing like a good drunkalogue, and I used to listen to them all. I still listen to them. I love them. They're important because we get to identify with the people and say, hey, he's just like me, and, you know, we come in here, we're so sure that we're so different, and we're unique, and nobody could possibly understand us, and the drunkalogue sort of like is the entry into sort of opening up your mind and say, I think I'll listen to this guy because he's like not like some of those other jerk-offs. He's just like me, you know. So drunkalogues are important. They're the key to sort of like get you to open up your mind and maybe listen. But the truth of the matter is, I was told a long time ago, your story will change. And all I had to share when I came in here was a drunkalogue. And, you know, I've been sober almost 31 years. And so I'm actually sober twice as long as I used to drink, you know, and raised a bunch of kids and done a bunch of stuff and had all that stuff happen to you that have happened to you in the world. And what I really like to talk about is sobriety, the miracle of sobriety. And I like to talk about emotional sobriety, the next frontier. Bill Wilson referred to it as the next frontier, emotional sobriety. And he said our real problem was unhealthy dependencies. And I like to, because I sponsor a lot of guys who, you know, 15, 17, 20, 25 years sobriety, that kind of stuff. And, you know, when you've been around for a long time, I'm not saying 31 is a long time. I have a sponsor who's got 57 years. But when you've been around for a long time, you see how immature sobriety, you see how mere physical sobriety pans out over a period of 10, 15, 20 years. I mean, you see what happens to a man who doesn't grow and mature in his relationship with God after 15, 20, 25, 30 years. You see the suicides, you see the deaths, you see people drinking after 20 years, you see people 20, 25 years, you sponsor them, who are miserable, who are living lives of quiet desperation, who are lonely, who are on their 17th divorce, their 18th marriage, whose kids aren't talking to them, who are alone, who aren't sponsoring anybody because nobody's asking them to sponsor them because they don't want what they have. And you understand that even though in AA we give you medallions, we give you awards for staying sober. I mean, you could be a Dexter, you could be a serial killer. If you got 15 years, come up here and get your medallion. You know what I mean? It's okay. We don't give out awards for integrity, for faith, for stuff like, you know, that's just something that people tend to notice somewhere along the separation, like they talk about six and step. This is the thing that separates the men from the boys. Happens over a period of time of perseverance. So you see that stuff. So I have a great heart. I have an incredible heart for new people. But I think I have even maybe a greater sort of ministry or heart for guys who have been around for 10, 15, 20 years and still haven't found that deal. You know, if you look at there's a story in the back of the big book called Alcoholics Anonymous number 3, where Bill Dodson talks about meeting Bill Wilson and coming out of the hospital and saying he knew there was something more. He says, I knew there was something more. I knew there was something I hadn't got. And, you know, a lot of people in AA will identify with the jaywalker, you know, the drinking, not being able to stop, and all that sort of stuff that we do. But how many people in AA, even at 15, 20 years, identify with the permanent emotional sobriety of the people who make statements that our Creator has become the center point of our life. He has done for us what we cannot do for ourselves. You know, we have experienced much of heaven and we've been rocketed into the fourth dimension of existence of which we had not even dreamed. As opposed to having 15, 20 years sobriety and I say, how are you doing? And they say, hanging in there. Listen, I guess we all got to go through that. We all got to hang in there. But, you know, really, there's more to it than that. You don't have to just hang in there. You know, there is something other than hanging in there. You know, although sometimes we all have to go through some rough spots. It says here, further on, clear-cut directions are given showing how we recovered. These are followed by 42 personal experiences. Each individual in the personal stories describes in his own language and from his own point of view, the way he established his relationship with God. That's what it says an AA story is supposed to be about. Otherwise, it's just another drunk story you tell in bars. And since the people in AA are pretty much the same people that I hung out with in bars, talking the same shit most of the time, except drinking coffee instead of booze, you know, I just like to talk about some stuff that they would never talk about in the bars that I hung out with, and that is how to establish and maintain and grow a relationship with God. Because they never talked about that stuff in the bars that I was in, which is probably why I divorced a beautiful wife of 5 years and lost my wife, my son, and my house, and everything that was important to me or should have been important to me, including my self-respect, because I never ran into a man who said, "Don't you have a wife at home? Don't you have a kid at home? What the hell are you doing here? Why don't you grow up and take care of business and be a man and be a husband to your wife and a father to that child?" I never run into that because I drank with alcoholics, and alcoholics don't think like that. As a matter of fact, if you talk like that and you're with alcoholics to talk about anything seriously, they want to put you down, they want to get mad at you and sort of make you go away. That's what alcoholics do. So when my first wife said to me, and I was 27 years old and 100 pounds lighter, and I was a division chief in the Dade County State Attorney's Office, prosecuting murder cases and supervising lawyers, and in the top of my game, and it was a Friday morning, and I was as sober then as I am now, probably more physically sober than I am now, and I certainly was brighter and smarter. You know, I came to AA, I had two neurons working, they were waving goodbye at each other, you know, so I mean, and I'm 62 years old now, and I don't have Alzheimer's, I have something called sometimers, you know, sometimes I know what's going on, and I've really gotten, AA has done a great thing for me, it's gotten me progressively stupider. You should have caught me before I came to AA, I was brilliant, you know, I knew everything, and, but apparently I've got AA, what it will do is you get rid of your old ideas, sometimes it won't even give you new ones, you just get rid of all the old ones, and you're sort of blank. But you know, when you don't have any ideas, you know what that means? That means you can't think. And when you can't think, that means you can't think. So you don't have to worry about that committee because there ain't nothing up there. You know what I mean? And you'd be surprised how stupid you can be and how much you don't have to think and you can still live quite well. You know, when I have to go to the bathroom, I go to the bathroom. You know, I mean, I just, when I go to sleep, I go to sleep. And you can wake up. You can go through the entire day without using your brain at all. It's amazing, you know, but... And I must not be that bright because everybody I sponsor tells me I don't understand. So I just don't get why they keep on asking me my advice, you know, if I'm so stupid. But they never take it anyway. So in any event, it was a Friday morning, and my wife said to me, I was about 27 years old, and she said, "I just wanted you to know that if you come home drunk one more time, I'm leaving you." I was about 100 pounds lighter than I am right now, and in a blue suit and a white shirt and a red tie on my way into court. And that's what she said to me. She said, "You come home drunk one more time, I'm leaving." She didn't say it to start a fight. She said it. It was almost like she was delivering the mail. "I just thought you ought to know." She's a beautiful gal. You know, she's a beautiful gal. I met her in college. You know, she walked in this classroom. All of a sudden, I looked at the door, and this pair of legs walked in the classroom. She was wearing short shorts. There was no head. There was no torso. There was just legs. You know what I mean? That's all I saw, legs. And I said, "Now, if I had her, I'd be okay." That's been the story of my life, you know. I've always been looking for her, the one that was going to fix me, you know. It may have sounded like I was looking for a car, but the only reason I was looking for a car was if you had a nice car, you had a better chance of getting her. And it may have sounded like I was looking for a good job with a lot of money, but the only reason I was looking for the good job with a lot of money is because if you get a good job with a lot of money and prestige, you have a better chance of getting her, the one that'll fix you. You know what I mean? And when I had her, I was okay. And when I didn't have her, I wasn't okay. You know what I mean? So her was a big thing with me. And, you know, I got to tell you something. I'm not sure I'm so alone in here because I've sponsored a lot of men who have gotten drunk looking for her, finding her, losing her. And you want to know something? I've met enough women in here to think that, you know, I'm not sure it's that different with the gals either. I'm not sure it's that much different with the gals. It's terrible to be drunk, be dependent on alcohol. You know, how many years? 15 years until I even considered the fact that I might have an alcohol problem. And then finally, when the whole thing crashes and burns and blows up because of alcohol, you're finally forced to admit, I need help, I can't stop drinking. You know, because drinking can really, over a period of 15 years, it takes a long time, it can finally get you to the point that I got to when the consequences of your drinking come at you faster than your ability to lower your standards. So you finally can't, you know, you'd be surprised how low you can get with alcohol and still think that you're doing better than everybody else. But alcoholics manage to be able to do that. They just tell themselves all these rational lies. They rationalize. When you think of that's crazy, you'd be amazed how many years and how many decades you could be sucking on the bottle of sex or men or woman, be addicted to the idea of romance, and think that this gal or this guy will, before you ever get to the fact and you realize that that's as much a drug for you as alcohol was. Or money, how you can be addicted to money, how you can be addicted to things. Let me tell you something, I was 9 years sober when they took away my credit cards because, let me tell you something, I spent more money I didn't have buying more things I didn't need to impress more people I didn't like than you could possibly imagine. I was 9 years sober, and I was a math major. I was 9 years sober before I realized if you spend more money than you make, you go into something called debt. Because all I knew is I wanted it, I had to have it, because somehow it would make me feel good, because I was addicted to stuff. And if you caught me in an A room, like any discussion room you would find in Alcoholics Anonymous, I was talking about the stuff I didn't have, the stuff I was going to lose, or the stuff that I wanted. You know, it was all about the stuff. And I'm working a program of recovery. He says, job or no job, a wife or no wife. You know, nonsense, bullshit. None of that is important. It all depends upon your relationship with God. And I'd mouth those words and I'd nod my head. There is one who has all power. That one is God. Don't try to manage your own life. No human power. Only God could and would if he was. And I'd mouth those words and I'd be working a program of recovery. And I'd walk out the room. And within 5 seconds, I'd be trying to manage it, trying to call up people, trying to figure out who was going to be there so that I could sort of control and manipulate so I can get stuff and get things. So I was talking AA through my mouth and reading AA, and I was like everybody else in AA. I think I was sincere, but the problem is I was so addicted to the world and that crap out there that was telling me that unless I could get an erection for 4 hours and take Viagra, there was something wrong with me. I mean, it's like the entire universe is designed, every billboard is designed to allow me to see how insufficient I am, and if I was only better, that deal. And I'll tell you something, if you don't understand that stuff has effect on you as an alcoholic, you don't know much about this disease. And so I buy this brand new car. I see this brand new car when I'm 19 years old. It was around 1970, 1971. It was the brand new Camaro Fastback. They never had anything like this. It looked like a rocket ship. You know what I mean? And I knew if I had this car, I had to have this car. You know, it's like, you know, if you're an alcoholic, you say, you know, I need a drink. You know, I didn't even realize that I didn't even suffer from alcoholism. I suffered from something called drunk. You know, you don't really, you know, one of the things I didn't realize about this disease, because I thought this disease had to do with drinking alcohol. Isn't that, I think most alcoholics think that this disease has to do with drinking alcohol. Isn't that right? Well, I haven't had a drink in 30 years. What am I doing here? I suffer from alcoholism, which has very little, you know, alcoholism, what I learned later on is really alcohol consumption is a symptom of this disease. We have a lot of symptoms of this disease. Alcohol consumption is but a symptom. It's a hell of a symptom. It'll get you arrested, you know, for driving. They'll arrest you for driving. They won't arrest you for driving while lusting or driving while coveting or driving while depressed, but they'll arrest you for driving while drinking. You can have all sorts of crap going on in your mind. You can have the committee working. You can be paranoid. They won't arrest you, but they'll arrest you for driving while drinking. And, you know, drinking will get so bad, and you'll get so locked into the drinking, into the bottle, where your world becomes a bottle, that you think that's what this disease is about. But I ultimately learned that what the big book told me, what I ultimately learned is men drink, women drink because they like the effect produced by alcohol. That we're restless, we're irritable, and we're discontented unless we can again experience a sense of ease and comfort, which comes at once by taking a few drinks. Drinks that they see others taking with impunity. And so I drank because that's the best thing. No woman, no car, no amount of money ever worked quite as well for me as just a few drinks. So I drank it. I drank alcohol so that I wouldn't have to suffer from alcoholism. As a matter of fact, I never suffered from alcoholism when I was drinking. Because every time alcoholism would raise its ugly head 15 miles away, I would look to my buddy and I'd say, pull over the car, I need a fucking drink. And I would drink, and there would go the alcoholism. I just get drunk. I suffered from something called drunk. That's why if you take an alcoholic and you get them drunk, and you take a regular person and get them drunk, they look exactly the same. You can't tell which one's the alcoholic. I didn't suffer from alcoholism, because alcoholism is something that happens to you if you don't drink. If you're sober, drinking is what gets rid of the alcoholism. Now, obviously, it got real bad for me. I started falling down, and you see people doing that all the time and drinking all the time. It's a real good clue that they suffer from alcoholism. But as soon as you take away the anesthesia, the pill, the crap I was using to chase away the alcoholism, then after a year or two or three of not drinking, now you understand why you drank. So, oh, man, now I know why I drank. This sucks. Rich, poor, whatever it is, this is crap. I need a girl. I need a job. I need a car. I need some relief. I need a meeting. A meeting. Then you can start using meetings. Nothing wrong with using meetings. I used them for 15 years. I still use them. I need a sponsor. I need anything, something addictively all the time just to make me okay, because I'm a basket case without this deal, because I suffer from something called alcoholism. Of course, what the big book tells you is what you need is God. You know, some people stay completely sober. Listen, I'm not putting this down. You may think I'm putting this down. You just have to listen. You may have to replay this deal. Some people never get really sober. What they do is they just stay physically sober, going from meeting to meeting, sponsor to sponsor, big book to big book, deal to deal. Same way I was doing scotch. There's no change. There's just the constant, it's just treading water. Just using meetings, sort of like I use scotch, just trying to do that deal. No change. They said God couldn't would if he was sought. There is one who has all power. It's all about growing in the image and likeness of your Creator. It's all about that sixth step and that seventh step and the changes that happen as a result of that. Of course, the meetings, all that stuff is absolutely necessary. So my wife says to me, first wife, you come home drunk one more time, I'm leaving you. You come home drunk one more time, I'm leaving you. I've analyzed that statement. I graduated with Departmental Honors in Mathematics. I was going for a doctorate in algebraic topology. I was a National Science Foundation fellow. I worship my brain. If you weren't ready to talk to me about the Schrodinger wave equation or the Heidelberg uncertainty principle, or calculus on manifolds, or quantum mechanics, I didn't respect you at all. It was about, believe me, I'm a recovering smartass. I'm a recovering know-it-all, okay? I know everything. I'm smarter than anybody. I'm sure you guys are laughing. You don't know what it's like. But, and the bottom line, and that's my deal. And my wife says, and I went to law school instead, and my wife says to me, you come home drunk one more time, I'm leaving you. Now, I've analyzed the statement. I'm a wordsmith. I'm a lawyer. If you come home drunk one more time, I'm leaving you. It's not a long sentence. I don't think there's an ounce of fat on that sentence. What word would you take out? What do you think is like the extra word? If you come home drunk one more time, I'm leaving you. So I got in my car. I drove to the first light. And this is what I said to myself. What the hell she mean by that? Now, let me tell you a little theory I've learned. Experience is very important. We all have opinions in AA. We sat in the bar, we gave our opinions. We all know we're all right. Well, let me tell you something. Screw the opinions. Experience is everything. My first sponsor said, when the man with experience meets a man with money, the man with experience will walk away with the money, and the man with the money will have walked away with an experience. The bottom line is, you give me a guy who's been through the jungle. If I'm going through the jungle and I got my choice between the guy who's read up on the jungle at Harvard and has a PhD in the Harvard jungle getting through the jungle deal and the guy who's been through the jungle 1,000 times and back again and made it, I'm going with the old crusty guy who's been through the jungle, okay? I've been through the experience. And let me tell you what my experience is in this. If you can be incredibly smart, you can be talented, you can be the most brilliant person in the world. If you get to the light and you don't understand the words, if you come home drunk more time, I'm leaving you. If that sort of throws you, you know what I mean? That's like when the judge says, if I see you before me one more time, you're going to jail. And you say, what the hell is that all about? If you really don't get that, okay, it doesn't sink in and you don't understand that, you're in for a sorrowful life. There's going to be some problems down the road. You may make a lot of money. There's going to be some Britney Spears stuff going on. You're going to be losing kids. You're going to be losing limbs. Stuff is going to be happening. You're going to be sitting here, how could this happen to me? You know, and the warnings were there. And what I realize is that one of the spiritual axioms, one of the axioms, one of the parts of our disease, which is part and parcel of the disease of being an alcoholic. I know this is true with me. I know it's true with the people I sponsor. I know it's true with alcoholics. Is that whenever an alcoholic hears, sees, or is told or reads anything they don't like, it confuses them. Doesn't matter how clear it is. It doesn't even matter how right it is. It doesn't even matter how true it is. It confuses them. And when they get confused and they don't like it, now sometimes they just get angry at it and make it go away. See, if you're a sponsor or a sponsee or a friend and you tell somebody, look, if you don't get rid of the heroin addict who's trying to kill you with the knife, you're going to drink again. They say, screw you, get it. You get angry at it. You can wipe that friend. You can make that friend go away. You just make it go away. And that's why a lot of people read this book. It's a big book. They read it. It's a big book, right? And they read it and they come to this part, a part here, you know what I mean? Let's say, I'll just pick any part. How about the part, the third step prayer? You guys know the third step prayer. How about the line right after the third step prayer? Nobody knows that. Let's talk about the line right after the third step prayer, for instance, okay? We're now at step three. Then he gives a third step prayer. And here's what the line after the third step prayer is. We thought well before taking this step, making sure we were ready, that we could at last abandon ourselves utterly to him. Abandon ourselves utterly to him. Now, if you don't like the God deal, and of course you got enough people, the majority of people, you understand that the fellowship is designed to make sure that you don't do the steps. You understand that, don't you? The fellowship is a group of people that is put here to stop you from doing the steps. You didn't know that? Okay, let me explain how this works. The fellowship is unfortunately made up of alcoholics. Alcoholics are crazy fucking people. This is a very serious... Trust me, if you ever walk out of an AA meeting shaking your head or you get mad at something, that's because this is not Well People's Anonymous. And not only that, it's made up of people whose chief characteristic is defiance. That's why although the book of Alcoholics Anonymous talks about your creator and talks about all this God stuff and giving yourself utterly to him and see your relationship with him is right and he will show you how to create the fellowship you say and all this stuff we know but a little, God will totally, even though the fellowship is, even though the book is constantly pointing you towards and 1,000 different words, God, 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 that's why the fellowship will tell you if he listens to it, don't believe that's bullshit, we only talk about how we don't talk about God, God has nothing to do with it. The fellowship is a group of alcoholics who would rather figure out how to do this thing without doing it. And if you tell them, if you read them something out of the book and they don't like it, they make it go away. They get angry at it. Unless they get about 15, 20 years and their life gets miserable enough and then they finally read it for the 18,000th time, they said I'm really there, and they stop playing around, they decide to grow up, and then all of a sudden it becomes part of their life. And, you know, they become like old timers and stuff and they start doing this stuff. But understand, you know, the majority of the fellowship, you got anywhere from people with one day to 25 years, you know, and there ain't enough 25-year-olds around. It's mostly 3 and 4 years that would rather not hear this stuff. So that's why you could actually read this book, just like my ex-wife. I wonder what they meant by that. You could read this book, and every time you come to a statement that sounds a little fanatical, and, you know, if you're an alcoholic, you got a problem. You can't stand the fact that people may not like you. Everybody's got to love you. I mean, the entire room could love you. If one guy doesn't like you, all you do is think about that guy. One person looks at you funny. You know, I was talking to a room of 3,000 people. They all applauded. One guy, 5 minutes before I was done talking in Toronto, walked out the back of the room. I don't know why he walked out. Probably his wife was pregnant. He was supposed to be somewhere. She was probably delivering a baby. And all I kept on thinking is, why did that guy leave? Well, that's funny, but that's alcoholism. Alcoholism is all about love me, accept me. You know, that's why you drink when you go to, you know, I used to, you know, it says, if fear of people will leave you. I said, I'm not fear of people. I love people. Well, then how come I was always drunk around them? You know, you walk into that bar, you know, will they like me? Will they accept me? Will the group accept me? You know, I have a couple of pops of that stuff. I feel like I own the group. You know, will she dance with me? Should I ask her to dance? A couple of pops. She says, no, I'm not going to dance with you. Hey, you're lost, honey. I'm petrified about being rejected and what some people think about me. And the bottom line is we all know that people laugh at people. People laugh at people that love God. People laugh at people that talk about God. People will look at you funny and humiliate you if you don't, if you talk about God. If you actually talk about this stuff, well, they call you, oh, he's a big book thump. They'll put down people that are fanatical about this book. They'll put down people because the whole thing is to be cool. To be cool, to be accepted by that, by the whack job that's sitting next to you, you know, that's not even paying your Visa bill. It's all about being cool. I got guys that are so cool, they're like bouncing out of the rooms. And so you got to understand the nature of the disease. It's not the alcohol, it's alcoholism, which is all about don't do this. I don't want to hear this. You're different. I'm unique. You know what I mean? I want to be accepted. If I do this, they'll laugh at me. That's going too far. I'll do this much, but I'm not going to do that much. It's all about not doing this. And every once in a while, you'll get a person in here, you know, one out of 50, that really decides they want to go further, and they'll latch on to an old-timer, a sponsor who's serious, and they'll cut the crap. And instead of being dilettantes and just playing games with this, they'll take it seriously. Because they want what we have. That's what it says. If you want what we have and you're willing to go to any length to get it, then you're ready to take certain things. You're not even ready unless you have a we. Unless you have a we, unless you have people in your life that you're looking at and saying, man, if I wish I could be like that guy. Not that we put them on pedestals, but in a sense we do. These guys with Bill Williams say, I want to be like him. Not everybody wants that. Some people just want their own life back. They want the car back. They want the big bed back. They want all that stuff back. And so the bottom line is, you'll get done reading this book, you'll read this entire big book, and you get to the end, and 90% of the stuff that you didn't like, that sounded a little bit too far out there, even though it's in black and white and it's in the book, you throw away, you cast it away, you toss it away, you don't even read it. You know, you read the funny stuff and the psychological stuff, but you toss all the other stuff away, and you get to the end of the book, and you decide to work the program of recovery, and you think what the program of recovery is, acceptance is the answer to all my problems. And you have wrapped this entire book in AA into the acceptance is the answer to all my problems. And listen, it's not. I mean, it's a nice statement. I understand what it means. For a certain time, it's certainly the answer to a lot of problems. When I was early on, I had to develop acceptance, but sometimes courage is the answer to your problem. That's why that's the second part of the Serenity Prayer, the courage to change things. And faith is always the answer to all your problems. But, you know, we don't want to talk about God and we don't want to talk about faith. We want to talk about acceptance. And the only relationships you ever want to talk about in here is romantic relationships, which step seven says is the last thing we should concentrate on because they don't help us. You know, romantic relationships are just like things to us. The only relationship we talk about is God. You know, so the point is we spend most of our time dancing around this book, trying not to do it, and the fellowship sort of like helps us do that thing, can help us do that thing. And just avoid the old-timers and the big book thumpers and the guys that sound like party poopers, ruin all the fun. You know what I mean? They're just going to ruin all the fun. And so in any event, I came to this thing, and I just, unfortunately, I fell in love with men, certain men in this program that I wanted to be like. I was brought up on John Wayne. I always wanted to be like John Wayne. John Wayne couldn't even be like John Wayne. But I always wanted to be that guy who was steady, who looked like he was in charge, who wasn't scared. And I was scared of everything, although I'd never admitted or even admitted to myself. And so one time I go to an A group when I was 3 months sober. My sponsor took me to this room, the keynote group, and this guy was speaking. He had about 30 years, and he was a guy named Al Kennedy. You know, and he was talking, I guess, you know, I'm sure doing a much better job than I'm doing tonight, and he was lifting up people, and he seemed so comfortable in his skin. You know, he sounded, you know, like I would watch these. I was a trial attorney. I was trying first-degree murder cases, and I could do that. But I could not talk from the podium. I mean, I could understand how you could try a case and talk about other people and do that sort of stuff. So I was a public speaker. But I couldn't understand how can these guys talk from the podium the way they talk about themselves like they don't even have notes or anything like that. It's because it's almost like they weren't scared. It's like they were transparent. It's like they were comfortable in their own skin. It's, and you know, my whole life was, what do they think if I say this? And what do I think if I say that? And you know, why did I say this? And why did I say that? And they probably think this. And he's probably laughing at that. It was, I was second guessing myself so much that I wasn't even going to do it in the first place. And if I did it in the first place, I'd spend the next 3 hours sucking my thumb worrying about what I said. And these guys were up there just sort of like talking about themselves and being transparent. It's almost like it didn't bother them for you to learn who they were, like whether you liked them or they didn't like them. Now, of course, as an alcoholic, I would often say, I don't give a crap what they think about me. But you know, everybody knows that people that say, I don't give a crap what they think about me, all they do is think about what other people think about them. Because people that really don't care about what other people think about them, don't say things like, I don't give a crap what they think about me. They say things like, pass the salt or I'll have the pizza. But they don't say that stuff. You know what I mean? And this guy was up there talking, and he was relaxed in his own skin, and I'm looking at John Wayne. You know, and I'm saying, I'd almost be scared. I wanted what he had. I'd almost be scared to hang out with him, because then he'd see the real deal, you know, who I really was. And I'm trying to figure out what his deal is. How can I be like him? I wish I could be like him, because I wanted what he had, and I didn't even know what he had. But I know I wanted it. I wish I could be like him. And he walks away, the meeting ends, and everybody claps and everything like that. And I turned to my sponsor and said, man, he was great. Because he lifted everybody up, and he made, you know, he's like one of these guys, like my sponsors were like this. No matter what was going on in your life, if you sat down with them for 30 seconds, you felt safe. He was a guy that if you were with him, you just knew nothing would go bad if he was there. Like he could handle everything, and he could answer anything. And my clients would, no matter what was going on in my life, if I saw my sponsor, and I had the most unbelievable problem, and I was terribly under-sponsored, I was looking for Albert Einstein and Jesus Christ rolled up into one, you know what I mean? And I got this guy who was a used car salesman, didn't even graduate sixth grade. But he was so brilliant, you know, I took him in my office, I showed him all my degrees. I said, these are all my degrees. He said, you know, Russ, rectal thermometers have degrees, you know what they do with those? Who talks like that? Who talks like that? One day he said to me, I swear to God, he said this to me. I had figured out, because I was worried about, I was trying to mathematically ascertain what's the smallest number of meetings I can go to and still be wonderful. You know what I mean? Because I wanted to get the proper balance. You know, I didn't want, because, you know, I had the family saying you still go to those meetings, and I had the world, and I'm not still in those meetings. I didn't want anybody, you know, worried about, you know, maybe a meeting. I wanted to go to meetings. I wanted to stay sober, but I didn't want to go to meetings. I knew I wanted this to become a part of my life and everything I wanted. And I was confused. So I figured out that I didn't have to go to meetings on Thursdays. I just figured that out. So I went to my sponsor and I told him, I said, I don't think I have to go to meetings on Thursdays. And at first he said, well, yeah, sure, as long as you never drank on Thursdays. Well, I had drank on Thursdays. So and then he looked at me and says, you know, Russ, because he recognized I was starting to think again. It was very dangerous for an alcoholic. He said, you know, Russ, you know as much about life as a dog knows about his father. Now, I was 31 years old. I had already been a father. I had been a husband. I graduated law school. I was trying all sorts of cases. I had heard a lot of stuff, done a lot of things in my life, even by 31 years old. And I was probably about 6 months sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I swear to God, I had never heard anybody talk to me or anybody like that. I just never heard those. I mean, where do you get these phrases from? There must be some like sponsor school in the middle of Georgia that they talk. I mean, I didn't even comprehend this. I used to comprehend higher mathematics. He says, you know as much about life as a dog knows about his father. Now I got to think about that. Because I'm thinking he's like complimenting me. You know what I mean? There's a compliment in there somewhere. Because now I got to figure out, how does a dog know his father? So all I could do was, as soon as he said that, and I'm not making this crap up. There was, you know, RCA. They have like a dog looking at this like Victrola, like with a patch on his eye. So I pictured that dog like the doggy daddy, and there'd be like a doggy mommy, and I pictured like doggy teenagers and doggy babies, like a doggy family, you know what I mean? Now I'm all doing this as like light speed in my head, you know what I mean? Because I'm trying to figure out what that means. And somewhere along the line, God gave me the inspiration to realize, I don't know whether you realize this, that dogs don't know their father. And so I put it together. When he said, you know as much about life as a dog knows about his father, he was telling me, I know nothing. Who talks like that? And so I turned to him and I say to him, I said, that guy Al Kennedy was incredible. Now I want you to put yourself in my place. I'm a member of the Alcoholics Anonymous. I joined the initial group. You belong to an Alcoholics Anonymous for the first 20 years. The Fellowship of the Thumb-Sucking Crybabies. You know, if you don't know what that is, you need to go to more discussion meetings. But in any event, you're not going to enough. But I was every day there was something that was going to explode, something to complain about, somebody had said this, something had done that. There was like a crisis, there was something to handle. There was like Saturday Night Live, there's always something, you know what I mean? Some sort of major thing, catastrophe, something I had to deal with, you know, that I needed my sponsor's help, that I had to work, you know, this and something to talk about. I mean, life was, it was wonderful, but it was tough, you know what I mean? It's difficult, you know, when you need to control everything, and you control everybody, and control the way we thought, listen, did I piss you off? Did I offend? It's 3 o'clock in the morning, yeah, but I noticed that you weren't looking at me funny. You were looking at me funny. You know, I'm like the two psychiatrists that cross themselves in the hall. One says hello, and the other one says, what the hell do you mean by that? You know, I mean, I'm it's always something that I gotta deal with and think about, because when you're scared, they say it's the corrosive thread that runs through your life. When you're scared about everything, you need to control everything and everybody, because if you don't have control, then something may happen to you, and it's not gonna, I don't know what it's gonna be, but it's gonna be bad crap, and it's gonna hurt me, and I'm gonna lose something, and I don't know what it is, but you gotta be awake and aware, and you gotta be on top of things, and constantly looking at all this sort of stuff, you know, that kind of deal. And that's the way you have to operate. But when you're not scared, you don't have to control anybody. But I don't know how not to be scared, because I've been like this. This is the way I am. This is like, you know, that my alcoholic life is the only normal life. And the only way I think is like this kind of thinking, even though it looks crazy, seems natural to me. And it seems unnatural to me just not to worry and let go and let God. And live one. That's unnatural to me. It seems crazy to me, as a matter of fact. And so I'm sitting in the meeting like you guys are sitting in this meeting. This guy's talking. He walks out the room. I guess I had just been on a 3-week jag talking about a hangnail or something, or who knows what I was worried about. And I turned to my sponsor, I said, that guy was great, and he says, you know, he's dying of cancer. And I said, I'm talking about the guy who just did the meeting, that guy Al Kennedy. And he says, yeah, he's dying of cancer. I said, no, the guy who just did the meeting, Al Kennedy, says, Russell, he's dying of cancer, he's got 3 months to live. I said, no, not that guy. He didn't say anything about dying of cancer. He says, I know. He didn't say a thing about dying of cancer. He says, I mean, I don't know about you, but I would have like at least hinted it. I mean, I would have said, well, you know, it's good to be here on Christmas Eve. Yeah, not important, but I'm dying of cancer. But I thought, you know, I don't know, you know, came up here anyway, you know, it's no big deal, don't worry about it, you know, and I would try to get, not even a thing. He didn't say a thing. 3 months later, Al Kennedy was dead. Do you know what that did to me? Well, obviously, it's been over almost 31 years, and I've never forgotten it. Do you know things will happen in your life where people will come into your life where you will see things and it will so impress you and it will change your vision about who you are. It says vision for you. You know, some people walk in here in a vision and they think what this thing is about is not drinking. That's what they think it's about, not drinking. And all my life I've been worried about dying. I've been worried about what you think about me. I've been worried about a million other things. And here's some guy who's dying of cancer and it's like all he's doing is trying to help people. He doesn't even mention it. It's like he was calmer than I am. And I'm saying, how the hell do you get that deal? How do you get that deal? And I walk around the Alcoholics Anonymous rooms and all I see is people scared out of their mind about everything. And 1 out of 1,000 is just, you know, just relaxed and ain't no problem. And that's the guy I wanted to hang out with. It says, God will show you how to create the fellowship. That's the guy I wanted to hang out with. Because I was convinced maybe if I just hang out with him, maybe something would happen like osmosis, you know, and I would get that deal, you know. I thought everybody saw it. I thought everybody wanted that deal. I was wrong. Not everybody wants that deal. Not everybody even sees that deal. You know, and that's what I wanted. That's the thing I wanted. And so those are the kind of guys that I hung out with. That was the kind of stuff I did. Those are the men I hung out with all my life, and I still hang out with them. I still do it even to this day. You know, to this day now. You know, and later on, a lot of other things happened to me. I mean, we don't have any more time now, but I mean, a lot of things happened. Those men took me to a lot of places. They pointed me in a lot of directions that I would have never gone to by myself, believe me. including church, which was kind of crazy for a Jewish kid, but that's another story. But, you know, our big book actually says we encourage church membership or synagogue membership or whatever membership you want to get in, you know, because when you're living a life, when you're trying to do this deal and it's all about him and it's all about focusing on him, you know, one of the things that happens when you focus on God, I'll tell you what happens when you focus on God. And one of the things you don't realize, I was driving up here on the turnpike and, on US 1. And you come to a place on US 1 and there's a giant sign. I'll just use this as an example. It's a huge sign. It's on the left-hand side. I was looking at it the other day. I wanted to take a picture of it. I wish I could use it at AA meetings. One day maybe I'll get a blow-up and I can use it. I can point it. It's a giant sign. It's a picture of a very, very beautiful woman. You can't see her face, only her body. In a bathing suit, which is almost fully exposed. The breasts are almost fully exposed, and they're large. You can't miss it, okay? And this is what it said in a beautiful bathing suit, and it says, breast implants on the bottom of it in red. Now, I don't know about you guys, but, you know, I still got a little man in me, you know what I mean? I've been not talking, and I look at that thing, and, you know, the first thing I say is, why don't I have that? Or if I only had that, I'd be okay. And then I realized, there you go. You see, that's what's out there killing you. That's what's out there is telling you no matter what's going on in your life, you're a father of four kids, you got a successful marriage, you got a successful business, you got four. That thing is telling you you're still not good enough. If I only had that, I'd be okay. And I had that and it wasn't okay at all. And then I'm thinking, but you know something? And what do the girls say? They look at that and they say, man, if I only had that, those breasts, I'd be okay. Or even if they had those braces, if I only had that bathing suit, I'd be okay. And I live in a world where every 5 seconds, so other people can make a buck, through movies, through TV ads and everything like that, I'm told subliminally and sometimes right in my face, if I only had an erection, I'd be okay. You know, if I only had, how many times have you been watching those TV commercials? Man, we're being so dumbed down, We're doing a program of recovery where it says only God will do it. It's only spiritual things, not the material things. And we do this for what? An hour? A day? Maybe? And then you walk out there and you're bombarded. Look at as you're driving away from me, I want you to look at the billboards. I don't know what they say to you. You know what they say to me? You know what they're saying to you? You may think you're looking at the billboards that say casino. You may think you're looking at the movies that say romantic comedies. All it's saying is you don't have that. You're insufficient. You don't have the money, you're a loser. You're not here in Vegas, you're stupid. You're not hanging out with us. All it's telling you is that you are not anything. You are nothing. You are by the time you get to your house, you're ready to have a drink or go to another meeting. And then you turn on the TV and you get more of that crap. So somebody else can get more money. And you don't think it has an effect on you? And so you run to your meeting and you get to this meeting and all of a sudden for 5 seconds you talk about God and other things, you feel a little bit good, and then you're out on the street again with the billboards or the newspapers. It's a serious disease. And I don't know about you, but I had to get serious about this thing, about who I hang around with, because who you hang around with, that's going to determine the conversation you have. And the conversation you have with the people you hang around with is going to be the same conversation you're having with yourself when you leave their presence. If all you're talking about is God, with guys and gals that are talking about sex and romance and love and money and things, when you leave, that's the only thing you're going to be talking about yourself in your mind. So when you go back to the meetings and talk about that committee in your head, just understand you're the one who's setting the agenda and the subject for that committee. Because of who you hang out with. The person you'll be in the next 5 years will depend upon the people you hang out with and the books you read. And the books you read are going to depend upon the people you hang out with. You know, that's just my experience in here. And believe me, and I'm going to end up now, none of this stuff that I'm talking to you about, which has been my experience, and things changed, of course, when I started listening to people and I started hanging out with the people I should be hanging out with and reading the stuff I should be reading, you know, things changed. But understandably, and I'm the first one to say it, they didn't change because I was jumping up and down saying, I can't wait to do this stuff. You know, I was like everybody else in here. I don't know, that sounds a little strange to me. Well, of course it sounds strange. You never did it. Just like going to AA meetings started training. Everything you've done in here, that has ended up being good for you, you did it because somebody else suggested it
either forced it upon you through circumstances, or you did it begrudgingly, you balked at it. And then you finally did it, whole hog, and it worked, and now you're the greatest, you know, proponent of it. But before you did it, it wasn't something that came that. This, I don't naturally think of doing this stuff like that. I almost have to be cajoled into doing it, or forced into it, or have a gun to my head to doing it. So all I do is I get up here and this is all we're supposed to do, just like it says in the book. I just talk about my experience. Doesn't mean you have to do it. You know, maybe you won't do it. Maybe you will do it. Maybe 20 years from now, you know, after living a life of quiet desperation, you'll think back and say, maybe that guy Russell, maybe that crazy shit he was talking about, maybe that'll work. You know? Because I don't think this is a dress rehearsal. I think this is probably the deal. You don't want to get to be 89 years old or whatever, get to the end of your life and say, man, I could have had a VA. Why didn't I do that stuff? You know? Why didn't I try that stuff? Why didn't I do the stuff they were talking, get serious about this deal? So thank you very much. God bless you. Merry Christmas.